It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Later in the hour, Iowa State University Theater has dedicated its 2019-2020 season to women. They're producing six very different plays written by women playwrights. We'll get a preview. But first, over the past couple of years, a few different movements raising awareness about sexual harassment and sexual assault, violence against women, missing and murdered Indigenous women, and the vulnerabilities of the LGBTQ communities have gained power, shining a light on how prevalent these problems are and empowering people to work for change. These movements haven't just been active in the United States. The voices of women and other vulnerable people are being amplified in many countries around the world. To give us some insight and perspective on this, I've asked two writers from two very different parts of the world to join us. They're both in Iowa City as part of the International Writing Program at the University of Iowa. Gabriela Roman Fuentes is from Mexico. She is a playwright, stage director, and actress. Her plays have been staged throughout Mexico, and much of her work focuses on women and sexuality. Gabriela, thank you so much for being here today.
Oh, thank you.
Also with us, Martha Mukaiwa is from Namibia in southwestern Africa. She's a freelance art, travel, and features writer. She is also an activist, writing about Black identity, Black womanhood, LGBTQ rights, and more. Martha, welcome.
Thank you for having me, Charity.
And Gabriela, I want to start with you. You are from Mexico, our neighbor to the south, and a place that a lot of people in the United States are familiar with, and maybe a place that we may think we're more familiar with than we are, that we know more about than we do. So tell me a little bit about where in Mexico you're from.
Where I'm from, Cuautla, in the south of Mexico City. It's a little city, but I have lived the last years in Mexico City because it's where things happen, you know.
Right, the draw of the big city.
Yeah.
So in the United States right now, we hear a lot about gangs, crime, and violence in Mexico and in different parts of Mexico. Living in Mexico City, tell me a little bit about what the reality is like for you. Obviously, these things are happening, but it's not all of Mexico. It's not everyone. But tell me a little bit more. Give me a richer picture.
Well, it's that you say it's a complex city because, I mean, you know that many of the news that you can read are truth, but also it's not that violent. So it depends of where you lived. That's the thing of a country like Mexico, you know, because there are some...
Like the United States.
Yeah. Like some areas that you're really... I mean, Mexico City, it's like a safe city, if you can say that. But the surrounding area, where it's another state, it's really dangerous, especially for young girls. So it's different, you know, it's like... always a matter of money too. If you are in a rich neighborhood, of course you don't have anything to worry about. But if you are in those surrounding areas, the metropolitan area, you will have to be careful all the time because it's dangerous to be woman, young, and poor. And yeah.
I don't want to ask you to overgeneralize things, but given that there are crises in so many different parts of Mexico right now, what do you feel is driving that? Why are things so dangerous?
I think it's always a matter of money and power, because the most dangerous zones in Mexico are all related with drugs too, but also with natural resources, you know, like gas, like oil, like all that thing. So yeah, I think it's a matter of money and power. That's why.
The culture in Mexico, many people characterize it as being a very patriarchal culture, very strong male culture, where women in their relationships don't have as much power as men. Do you think that's a fair characterization?
Yes. I mean, maybe not in all over the country, of course, but yes, it is. Yeah, even if women have a lot of power inside the family, they repeat this kind of, you know, this patriarchal way of behaving. And yeah, but it is truth.
What have you experienced that has made you so passionate about women's issues?
I guess I was really touched by the fact that there's a lot of kind of violence, and it's not only because I can say I never suffer anything for real, you know, real violence to me, but there's a lot of little things that goes every day that I felt that we need to change, you know, like the liberty of sexual liberties, liberty of speech and everything. That's what I was really taught about that. And of course, this increasing number of violence against young girls, and because they're poor, because they're indigenous people, all that really touched me. That's what I thought I really need to talk about that.
Have women that you have been close to suffered from violence?
Yeah, some of them, yeah. Yeah, you know, like people, you know, some friends that know them, some, I don't know, like her sister, a friend of mine, her sister was killed by her husband. And at first we said it was a suicide. And it's like a common way to hide the assassination.
Yeah. So a woman who is murdered by her husband, he would make it look like it's a suicide.
Yes. Yeah.
So that he would not get blamed.
Yeah.
Does it feel like a lot of men can get away with violence against the women in their lives?
Yeah. Yeah. You mean get away, like escape?
Like not have to pay for it.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that's one of the major reasons why men do a lot of things, because you know you won't pay anything for that.
You mentioned the vulnerability of indigenous people, which is something that we know about here in the United States, that indigenous people are victimized at a much higher rate. Is it the same in Mexico?
Yes, yes. That's why the second play I wrote in my life was about that. I talk about a little girl who's a girl, young, indigenous, poor, arriving to Mexico City, because I thought it was like the most vulnerable group, maybe one of the most in Mexico, because it's difficult. You know, we love them in the screens, but not in the streets. So, yeah, it's hard being an indigenous people there.
With so many migrant people moving through Mexico, which again is something that we hear a lot about in the United States, what is the problem with human trafficking like? Do you find that many of those people are disappearing? Children, women disappearing?
Yeah, I think it's a big problem. I can't even realize how big it is, because, you know, it's hidden, but I think it's quite big. A lot of people, because it's increasing the people that is coming to Mexico. So we don't really know how big is the problem.
I want to turn to Martha. Let's find out a little bit about Namibia. Now, Namibia is a very small country in southwestern Africa. So a lot of people in Iowa aren't necessarily going to be familiar. Tell me just a little bit about the country itself.
Okay. So yes, as you say, it's in southwestern Africa. It has 2.6 million people. It's a big country, but we all have a lot of personal space because there aren't very many people in it. What else can I tell you about Namibia? It's a really beautiful country. A lot of people come to Namibia to experience incredible wildlife, like safaris, beautiful natural landscapes. A lot of photographers come to Namibia because apparently the light is incredible. So it's a very beautiful place to live. It is an ex-colonial country. It was first colonized by Germany and then South Africa. So it shares an apartheid legacy with South Africa, which a lot of people aren't familiar with. And it is only independent from that for 29 years, so since 1990. So it's a young country too.
Yeah. Well, and let's talk a little bit about its colonial history with Germany, because I think that that's important. Of course, colonialism is an important part of Mexico's history as well. But really, some of the understanding of what was going on with German colonialism in Namibia is really just coming to light. Mm-hmm. So tell me more about that.
Well, if you go to Namibia, Windhoek, a lot of people call Namibia and specifically Windhoek Africa for Beginners, because it's very modern. You will find a lot of German tourists come there to see the old churches, and a lot of the streets are still have German names. If you walk into a bakery in Namibia, you will find like Brötchen, which is like a German bread. You'll find German sausage in the aisle. So there's a lot of colonial residue in Windhoek and in Namibia and in a coastal town called Swakopmund. Also, of course, the economic power is still in the hands of German people. German people own a lot of the businesses. Most people work for German companies. So that economic shift hasn't happened, like the wealth hasn't been redistributed. Of course, there are issues of racism still in Namibia that are compounded by the fact that we also had apartheid. So it's kind of like a double discrimination.
And with that early German colonialism, there was a genocide.
Yes, of course. There's what is coming to light now is that all the conversations people are having about reparations, because in, I think it was 1904 to 1908, there was a Herero and Nama genocide, which exterminated hundreds of thousands of Namibian people. The Namibians are trying to get it recognized officially as the first genocide and sort of the blueprint for the Holocaust, because there were concentration camps, there was the poisoning of wells. So yes, those conversations are happening now, and it's quite a fraught conversation in Namibia. But yes, that's all part of the color and the culture and the history and the current reality of contemporary Namibia.
Right. The legacy of genocide is so powerful. And again, something in Mexico, something in the United States, something that so many different parts of the world have experienced in different ways. We are going to take a short break and we'll be back in just a moment. My guests today are both writers who are in Iowa City as part of the International Writing Program at the University of Iowa. And we're focusing on the experiences of women around the world, the vulnerabilities of women in other communities, LGBTQ communities, indigenous people as well. We will continue our conversation in a moment. With me, Martha Mukaiwa from Namibia in southwestern Africa. Also with me, Gabriela Roman Fuentes, who is from Mexico. Our conversation continues in a moment. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Right now, we are exploring the experiences of women and other vulnerable communities around the world. Of course, in recent years, the Me Too movement and other movements have really shown a light on the vulnerabilities of women and other communities like the LGBTQ communities, indigenous people and their vulnerabilities. The voices of women and these other vulnerable people have been amplified in the United States and also around the world. And so to give us a little perspective on this, we've asked two writers from very different parts of the world to be here today. They're both in Iowa City as part of the International Writing Program at the University of Iowa. Gabriela Roman Fuentes is from Mexico. She's a playwright, stage director, and actress. Her plays have been staged throughout Mexico. Martha Mukaiwa is from Namibia in southwestern Africa. She's a freelance art, travel, and features writer, and she is also an activist writing about Black identity, Black womanhood, LGBTQ rights, and more. And Martha, before the break, you were giving us a little bit of a history of Namibia, a country that a lot of people don't know very much about. I'm sure that when you're meeting people in the United States, you get a lot of questions.
Yeah.
About Namibia. So let's talk a little bit. We've been talking about the history and the legacy of that history, but tell me about Namibia today. I've read some of your articles about the vulnerability of women in Namibia today, but paint a picture for me culturally, economically. What's happening there now?
Okay, well, I think a lot of Namibian women are trying to lift themselves out of poverty. I think this year, a chancellor at the university said that they had, you know, a record number of women graduates and actually more women graduating than men. So I think that women are feeling empowered by global women's movements and getting their education and trying to better their individual lives. So I think that's wonderful. In terms of women in Namibia, we have a lot of incredibly powerful women in Namibia, which is really inspiring for young girls. We have a first lady who is very vocal about women's rights. She has been vocal about LGBTQIA plus rights, and who has various programs across the country which are meant to uplift women and girls and just women, people in general, in a modern and with a focus on equality. So we love her. She is a national treasure, and she's a woman who is in an incredible position doing, you know, the Lord's work.
Tell me about your personal experience. What has made these issues so personal and so important to you?
Writing about women?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, selfish reasons. I'm a woman. I'm a Black woman. So I have experienced, you know, I've experienced violence. I've experienced, you know, the mundane street harassment and catcalling. I'm trying to better my life, but I'm trying to better my sister's life. I know that this is and my friend's life. I know that this is a global problem. And I think that it is, I couldn't not be doing what I'm doing because I have to live in this world. I have to open the newspaper and see that this one has been murdered or raped. And that affects me. I don't know how it wouldn't affect someone. So I think it was very natural to use my talents and my platform to write about women.
Namibia has a very high unemployment rate. Read, what, 33%
yes.
unemployment rate. And that contributes, of course, to just so much vulnerability for so many people in the culture. Do you feel like that contributes to making women in particular extra vulnerable?
Yes. I think that when there is high unemployment, people make decisions that aren't necessarily in their best interest. If you are a woman and you are being abused, but you don't by your male partner or by your male significant other, you don't feel like you can leave that situation because what will you do for food? What will you do for your children's school fees? So you stay and encounter abuse, and sometimes that abuse ends in murder. The two most prevalent forms of gender-based violence, you call it countering violence against women in America, are domestic violence and rape. So this is intimate partner violence, and this is because people are clinging to each other because they don't have economic freedom and they don't feel like they have economic power. I think that the reverse of that is then, as I said, a lot of women are trying to uplift themselves in Namibia. So you do also get situations where the woman is the breadwinner. The woman is the one who has the economic power, and to cut the woman back down to traditional and patriarchal size, there is abuse. Because if I'm not bringing in the money, if I'm not feeling, you know, male and powerful in that way, then I'm going to feel male and powerful with my fists. So I think it works in both those instances. The fact that people don't have that economic power and economic freedom because of the lack of employment.
Gabriella, I see you nodding your head. Does this sound very familiar to you in thinking about what you've observed in Mexico?
Yes, absolutely. Because as I was talking about this metropolitan area, where you see people who work all day and need to travel almost all day to go to their jobs, and what they can get getting home, I guess it has to be real difficult for them. So I think it's always related to the economic situation and the violence behind it.
When the Me Too movement really took off here in the United States, I mean, there was just this deluge of women sharing their stories, both about sexual harassment and also about sexual assault, sexual violence as well. And not just women, but men and other members of other vulnerable communities as well. So tell me, in Mexico, how you started hearing about the Me Too movement and how people in Mexico responded to that.
I think there was a huge response to Me Too in Mexico, especially in literature and theater. And there was a lot of people who was pointed out. And most of them, at least, they are now in legal process. So it's a good way, but we also have, you know, the other side, that some people have just won grants, and there are people who are in legal processes from rape and such kind of things, and they won grants from the, yeah, from the government. So it's difficult because it opened a door, but it's still a lot of things to be done.
Yeah. Did you see the same thing people sharing on social media?
Yes, a lot. It was really a special time because the people was really, we were suffering because it's difficult, you know, when a friend make come out and it's like really, so like a woman, a feminist, you have to make a lot of questions, not to just point out, but really to question yourself and all that surrounds you.
Yeah. So when the Me Too movement broke in the United States and in other places in the world, how did you experience that in Namibia, Martha?
Personally, I was incredibly excited. I write a personal column every Friday, and I wrote a big Me Too column, and then I got all the crappy comments when it got posted on Facebook. I think when it broke in America, Namibian women particularly were curious, but maybe not as vocal as this year, where we have had an incredible, you know, almost like a delayed response to the Me Too movement. In May this year, there was, like you say, a deluge of people coming, of women coming forward in, I said May this year. Mm-hmm. And it has been a groundswell, an incredible thing. If you can search the hashtag Me Too Namibia, and you'll see a bunch of stories, women naming and shaming their abusers, women, holding the hands of those women. And more than that, Me Too Namibia movement is actually like a practical movement that exists beyond the online space. So the Me Too Namibia has alliance members like the Namibian Women's Lawyers Association and then also Bel Esprit Mental Health Clinic. So they actually take that, that courage from the digital space and bring it into real life and actually give women psychosocial support and then also give free legal assistance for women to come and report their cases. Because it's all well and good to say, okay, this person did this, but we're trying to get women to actually report their abusers in the traditional way and get some kind of recourse so that men feel consequence. Because, you know, when you name and shame someone on social media, it's like, oh, you had a bad week, but there is actually a legal process to go through, and that is what our Me Too Namibia is creating, a holistic solution for women who want to come forward.
Well, and coming forward in social media, not coming forward through the courts, that also makes a woman very vulnerable.
Absolutely.
Especially if she is naming a perpetrator or an alleged perpetrator. Is there a fear of a backlash of women getting hurt because they're stepping forward in this way?
I don't think of getting hurt, but definitely shame, definitely having people trying to discredit to you in some way, like, oh, you did this, oh, you wear this, oh, I always see you at this bar, oh, you said this. But then there's also the reverse of that, where people are saying, okay, this person has been named and shamed, why are you still a patron of their club or of their business? And that's really what you want. You want some sort of consequence. So I think that in Namibia at the moment, women are supporting women, and it's been an incredible thing to see. We have young activists like Nsozi Mwazi, who is one of the organizers of something called the Slut Shame Walk, which is a take on Amber Rose's Slut Walk. And it was trying to call attention to the fact that, what we wear is not an invitation to be raped, kind of thing. So a lot of those movements and a lot of those ideas are gaining traction in Namibia in a very public and vocal way. So I think that more than anything, people are supporting, and particularly women are supporting, these movements.
I think in the United States, a lot of us like to think that although we haven't achieved full gender equality, that maybe we're ahead somehow of other places around the world. And everything that I'm hearing you say, I know that those things are happening in the United States as well. Are you finding, when you're talking to people from the US and these writers from other places around the world, are you finding that you have a lot more in common than there are differences?
I guess in common, I don't know. I mean... It's hard to say.
I think this experience of being a woman does have some, global threats, definitely. I think that I don't know a woman who hasn't experienced street harassment. I don't know a woman who hasn't thought, did I maybe not get that job because a woman? I haven't ever met a woman like that. It would be nice to meet a woman like that. So I think that we can definitely find touchstones, and that I think that there is a level of kinship in being a woman wherever you are.
You are both here because you're writers, and you've done a lot of nonfiction work, yeah. Martha, although you're experimenting with fiction and other things. And Gabriella, you have focused on writing plays and on fiction work, and you've written a lot about women and sexuality in this work. Why do you think it's important to explore that through art, through fiction?
Because I think there's an emotional connection. I mean, not just talking about sexuality, but also about rights, for example. I wrote and perform a play about my aunt and many social movements in Mexico and around the world related with the cloth industry.
The textile industry.
And I think it could be real boring just to hear about the women working around the world in the textile industry. But as I have a personal and intimate connection with it, I believe that people, that the audience, were also touched by the facts, by my story, my aunt's story, because it has a face. And I think that the power of art to put a face in a problem, like, you know, violence against women. No, it's someone with a face, with a story, with a name. So I think that a good way to go through the people, and that they can really feel and start making questions. Yeah.
Martha, I've read some of your work as a journalist, mm-hmm. and knowing that you're also experimenting with fiction and other forms, your nonfiction work is very powerful. I mean, you've told really searing stories and told them very well. Why is fiction attractive? Why look in that direction instead of journalism?
You know, if in terms of fiction, I don't know that I would be writing necessarily about women or violence against women. But I did want to make a comment on just when people say you're a journalist or you write nonfiction, people think that it's really dry. But I write creative nonfiction or narrative nonfiction. So I think that what I really try and do is add some humanity to the headlines. So I am, like you said, very descriptive, sometimes really searing. I try and elicit some sort of emotion, because I think that people are desensitized. They read a headline, okay, this woman died, she was murdered, here are the details. Whereas I really try and create like some empathy and try and help people to remember, you know, the names and the details and the time of day, and just try and connect people on a human level to what is just a recurring sort of nightmare. So in terms of fiction, I mean, I think every writer wants to write a great fiction book. I have been experimenting. Actually, I have been experimenting with writing about violence against women in fiction. I'm doing a reading at Shamba House this Friday at 5, shameless advertising. And you can see how I sort of bring that into, I'm reading a fiction story about violence against women called The Solitaires, and then also columns about violence against women, which are in the mold of narrative nonfiction, which isn't straight news at all, which is emotional, which is meant to make you remember that we're dealing with human beings, not just headlines.
We are nearly out of time, so in 20 seconds or less, what do you think you'll take away from this experience in Iowa in your writing? I know, an impossible question. Yeah. Martha, you go first.
Oh, I mean, just like an incredible sense of validation. This is the weirdest place in the world. People are so interested in writing and literature, and we are little rock stars here. And it's just been very validating. We come from, you know, if you're a writer anywhere in the world, people think you need to get a real job, you need to get serious about life. And here it feels like you have a real job and you are serious about life. So I'm going to take that courage and validation with me to Namibia, and it has been an amazing time. Don't miss the rest of our events.
And Gabriella, how about you?
I feel less lonely because what Marta said, but also because I know that even those who are really such wonderful writers, they're still having fear and struggling every day for to write and survive and everything. So I feel like I'm part of something. Yeah.
Gabriella, thank you so much.
Thank you.
And Martha, thank you so much.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Gabriela Roman Fuentes is from Mexico. She is a playwright, stage director, and actress. Her plays have been staged throughout Mexico. Martha Mukaiwa is from Namibia. She's a freelance art, travel, and features writer. She's also an activist, writing about Black identity, Black womanhood, LGBTQ rights, and more. They are both in Iowa City as part of the International Writing Program at the University of Iowa. Coming up in just a moment, Iowa State University Theater has dedicated its 2019-2020 season to women. They're producing 6 different plays written by women playwrights. We will get a preview in a moment. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio.